Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, brought to you with the support of the School of Business Management and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is part three of episode 39, where we are discussing Cohen, March, and Olson's 1972 article, A Garbage Can Model of Organizational Choice. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. So part three of the podcast is where we talk about implications and what we think this might, how this research we think relates to the real world. So Pedro, do you have some ideas?
I actually do. When I read the paper, one of the things that struck me was the issue about attention. And I think they say there's something about that in organizations cannot, you know, divert rotations to everything all the time. They have to make choices and so on and so forth. And a lot to what they talk about, you know this continuous effort to apply solutions to problems. Apply solutions to problems, so on and so forth. Make me think about studies that have been done more recently about the work of CEOs, which we think about it is actually some of the main people that are, represent the organization and are, orchestrating all the different processes that happen. So I'm thinking specifically there is work that has recently been done by Davide Nicolini and Maya Koritsa from Warwick Business School, in which they scheduled a number of CEOs in the NHS in England, and they were kind of, reproducing, replicating the work done by Mintzberg and others that, go and naturalistic observe how top leaders go about their work. And they have interesting insights on how they divert their attention and how they, are able to attend to the different things that are thrown at them. So it was interesting parallel I didn't think of how much this discussion of the garbage can, while it is at the organizational level, translates for top leaders.
I think that's a great observation. I hadn't really thought of it translating it from all organizations to just the conditions that face the top leaders. But if you think about this idea of these choice opportunities and solutions looking for problems, and the fact that choices and problems migrate around, I think that's a great idea that it would relate sort of at that, maybe that micro level, because there's so much that the CEO sees. So that research, I'm sure, is very applicable.
Yeah, when I think about that too, there's sort of the question that crosses my mind as far as, the models and the theories that we're discussing talk about how organizations are behaving, how they are rendering decisions. And the associated question is, well, should they be doing it this way or should they be doing it some other way? And what I mean by that is, like, for example, in the organizations that I've been in, there's been a tendency to put increased decision-making responsibilities at higher levels.
Oh, yeah.
And for various reasons, environmental, external stakeholders wanting to have greater accountability for those in charge, crisis, which causes perhaps a tendency to migrate decision making to more important people, and perhaps the media environment, which puts much more of a spotlight on the leaders. That basically says if they're not the ones who are making, certifying, championing the decisions that they make, then you have some sort of a problem. Of course, we in the Army have been trying to run kind of counter that for quite some time. We have had a tradition of delegating and
local autonomy,
increasing the autonomy at lower and lower levels. But that's really it's easy to say, and in some ways it's easy to do, but the expectations that are set upon by the external environment, the demands for information, the demands for action, demands for whatever, really pile up generally on the senior leaders. And the senior leaders, of course, are running around like – well, I shouldn't say running around like crazy, but there is a tremendous amount of pressure. Yes. And a tremendous level of energy that is being expected upon them. And you wonder, okay, is that healthy? Is that unhealthy? Is that the way that things really should be done? What's the right answer? That's obviously a very complex question that has a lot to do with the organizational culture and the relationship with stakeholders, but it's one that really does need to be asked.
Well, as an implication for practice, based on what you were talking about, I want to give one example and then one suggestion. The one example I can think of is that I've been in organizations where we had external stakeholders that could make my life very difficult. And so my people in my organization had a lot of local autonomy to make decisions. And what we found out was many times when they said no to the external stakeholders or the customer, that rapidly got to the top of that other organization. And I got hit on the head very quickly right after that. So I could have said, okay, I'm the only guy going to make decisions from now on. But I didn't think that was very practical. So I said, well, my response is going to be, if you think you have to say no, you have to tell me first, you know, that you're going to say no, because I would find out that people were trying to do the right thing and they felt they were preserving the organization's resources appropriately, and they would say no. And I would have to go back to them later and say, no, we can say yes to this, or I shouldn't say no, we can say yes. But I was able to say no isn't appropriate here. And I gave them some guidelines for when they could, you know, when they would have decision autonomy on their own, but when they had to consult with me. So that made it so I didn't have to make all the decisions, but also I could have some influence on when I was going to get hit in the head. Because there were times when we were asked to do something that wasn't legal. And it wasn't like obviously illegal, like shooting somebody, but it was, okay, we wanted to spend money on this thing. And because the contract wasn't in place, it wasn't allowed. And so I knew I was going to take a hit on the head anyway, but I felt justified when I could say, I'm not authorized to do that. And I felt like I had to be the one who had that reply.
Autonomy also becomes interesting when you start thinking about evaluating potential solutions to problems you may or may not be having in the organization, because obviously in a large organization where interdependence is really important, like we think about military organizations, they have to be very they have to be interoperable. You can't have too much anarchy. I mean, anarchy there, when we're talking about each unit organization potentially pursuing its own solutions, obviously, there's a degree to which that has to be capped in order to preserve the ability of the organization. You know, if the organization has to sustain interoperability, that kind of behavior has to be capped. So, where's the balance? It's really hard, and that's a continuing question that I think, you know, organizations of military organizations have to face, because they do need sometimes not to have to wait for the big program to come through decades later. They need sometimes solutions now. Okay, so how do you systematize those type of decisions is very difficult.
Yeah, that balance between flexibility and cohesiveness or standards.
I actually noticed that I cited the research, but I didn't say the insight of the research, what it was.
Yeah, it would be helpful to do that. We'll splice that back in. Go ahead.
No, but basically, you know, it relates to discussion of the top leaders and autonomy and so on and so forth in a way, because I think one of the things that the paper says, and I think the research done by Davide Nicolini and Maya Koritsa kind of points that direction as well, is that the paper says that you don't have to solve all ambiguity before, you know, making decisions and going about the organizational issues to be solved. You know, so there's the idea that, you know, we don't have to wait, and that organization actually never wait until everything is clarified so they can act upon it. It's actually, if anything, in many situations, the opposite is normal. You know, they just use and recollage what they have and plug it in the things that are being thrown at them. And the research that has been done on exactly on how CEOs direct your attention kind of shows the same thing in a way. as it shows that CEOs don't have the luxury of the time to just stop and reflect deeply on something because there are multiple problems that are being thrown at them continuously. Of course, as you know, you both were saying, it's the question whether they should be the ones handling all this kind of decisions or not. But, you know, in cases that they are, what they have noted in the research is that they do that by continually thinking aloud and weaving the different things that they're hearing from different parts and kind of, you know, putting people together around these different problems. So it's not necessarily them themselves are trying to solve them, but they're trying to think of ways in which they, as they reflect on them, they kind of bring the different people that can handle them. You know, so that was this idea of not just hoping to have a finished picture, but acting on the issue as it's happening and, you know, creating the picture together with people in an interrelated way, if that makes sense.
It does make sense, and I think that's a very insightful point because it brings back what I had mentioned in episode one was the lack of agency. When you take the people out of it and just say, here's how these processes work, yes, you develop a certain understanding or you can see some themes. And I think one of the things you're pointing out is agency plays a huge role, and you've seen that in the research that's been done on CEOs with David Nicolini and others, because now they're talking – now there's this – idea that the CEO isn't necessarily solving it, but he's helping position people who he thinks would have good input to the solution, which is, I think, very important for organizational problem solving. And I think that's another reason why, you know, Miranda is right to be a little more optimistic about how organizations respond to problems, because there is that, you know, that behavioral aspect.
So generally speaking, in terms of applications of the model, I think one of the major applications that comes to my mind is the idea of organizations creating problems, which could, which is a bit pushed to the extreme, but I find it quite, it ties in quite neatly with the field of marketing, as I said before.
So what do you mean by creating problems?
Well, when I studied marketing, and I only did it like at university, there was this idea of marketing being founded on the induction of consumer needs. So needs that consumers were not aware of, and the organization was there suggesting products to solve these needs. So that was the basic ideas that I remember from my studies. But
right. So that, an example might be Apple introducing an iPad when, you know, no such thing existed, and then either manufacturing or inspiring people to say, here's how this solution fits into a need that you didn't know you had. Is that, yeah, would that be a fair way to say
that? That was general idea of the foundations. And then I think that generally in terms of applications to the real world, I just struggle with the simplistic nature of the model, which is part of the nature of the model per se, but at the same time, it makes it a bit difficult to see in reality. So there's definitely this idea of businesses being developed from the definition of an opportunity of a problem, but it's kind of like a reverse order. So that is my major challenge or dilemma with this piece of work.
Well, certainly some of the things that I think would be kind of neat to extend the model just to if we were to use this particular model that they presented and to try to enhance it with so some of the aspects of it that we've been saying it's kind of short in. One of the things I think would be kind of fun is to talk about this or to have the model do model of the CEO decision-making process like what Pedro was talking about. Because right now, you know, it's solutions are just solutions. So what about the process in which a CEO decides whether or not to bring other assets in, like say the immediate reports are resources available or solution part of the solution set, and decides to go that route versus CEOs who act impulsively and decide to take a direct path to a solution that they think would be really, really interesting or really helpful, which may or may not be more risky, versus deferring, versus doing nothing. Is it possible that a model such as this could help perhaps, you know, add something to that conversation about CEO decision-making processes?
I think in part that's where the model and the Carnegie Mellon tradition starts to break and crumble, because I understand that they are trying to do two things at the same time, you know, preserving these very formal ways in which they handle questions, but also trying to look at, you know, how things happen in organizations. But then there is the whole issue that, you know, Ralph, we're talking about agency and you're talking about preferences. You know, we talked a bit about politics before, you know, and when Birano was talking about overarching goals versus, you know, the more political conflict that exists. And when you start to look at those things, I think in a way, maybe the model starts to crumble, because then you're introducing things that are, how can I say, from the guts of the organization, from how they really happen, from like the really people that are populating them, that having this preference that are based, you know, we can go with politics, we can base on the position they sit in the organization, or it can be personal history, as you're referring to in the case of the CEOs, you know, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I think I like the way you look at that, Pedro, and talk about the model either breaking down or the approach breaking down. And of course, every model has its limitations. I think one of the limitations we're seeing here is that if you just look at things like solutions, choices, the problems that are coming into the organization, you know, just so the participants in these choice situations that you have, you're only going to have a limited understanding of the way the organization functions. And so I think you really hit the nail on the head there when you said, well, you go down some of these other paths where you can have these influences and you can say, well, why does this happen and what role does leadership or choice play in this particular aspect? Then you're going really beyond what the model can tell you. So I do think the model is interesting from the perspective of, okay, what kind of insights do you get when you make this abstract model of an organization and its decision processes? But it's clearly not going to tell you everything about how organizations function, or in certain situations it won't be useful at all.
I kind of, you know, feel that I have played bad cop, and I have to play a bit of good cop.
Yeah, really. Yeah. So you're just trashing the approach. So now it's time to, okay,
I do say something that I think is very valid and goes beyond the specific, you know, content of the model. I think it's the main insight in which they're trying to say that all these things, the whole point of the model is looking at the interdependence among these different variables. So the interactions about, you know, the problems, the solutions, the people, the flow of the problems, the way the structure is organized, and so on and so forth. And that actually is a good handle from where to start. Again, you know, as Neil was saying, if you want to go and look at model the CEO behavior, then you start to, I think the insight would be not only look at the preference, like it's someone that is more centralizing CEO or one that delegates more, but they also have to look at that in relation to, I don't know, the flow of problems that this organizational has, you know, what kind of, I don't know, energy that exists, we can translate into resources and so on and so forth. So.
Well, also how about the way they actually identify things as problems, right? Because that is problematic in some organizations. So it takes them sometimes some latency is involved in it, and you see some phenomenon before it's actually organizationally recognized as a problem. So I think one of the things I think you're saying, Pedro, what I agree with, is that the model does tell you some very interesting things about organization or some implications. And then I think what you'd want to do is say, okay, well, you don't just stop there. That's where Miranda got a little frustrated, and I agree with her. It's like, okay, we just stop. And you'd want to go further down many of the implications that they have for the model and do additional research. So I think that's what Tom and you were talking about when you said, well, we'd want to look at what what role the CEO's choices have on how problems get solved and the makeup of the personnel that are making the choices. I mean, I think their implication seven, this idea that important choices just appear to happen, you know, because they're less likely to resolve problems or, you know, then the interaction with unimportant choices, that would be a good research question to go down and say, well, what's that look like in organizations? And what are you seeing about how those choices get made by actually observing what they're doing? Because the model suggests some interactions, but what do you see when you actually look at some organizations that might be at least part of the time characterized as anarchic decision, anarchic models.
Yeah, what I would also add is that you could either go the tack of taking that question and looking at it qualitatively, you know, sort of through interviews or some such to find out more, or by making the model more sophisticated. I mean, one of the things about this model, by the way, too, is that it was written at a time when computing was extremely limited and there was very little that you could do with computers. You know, they basically did a lot with a very little code. So when we think about just how sophisticated we can model human behavior nowadays, and you don't even have to model human behavior. You just take, say, a similar mathematical approach and build a model that can at least address that and see if there's, what I might say, is there a there? You know, is there something to explore based on building a more enhanced model? I would suspect that there is, and for a number of the things in which we're talking about, I think that there can be some additional insights from using a more sophisticated model that addresses a little bit more of the theory since 1972 that might lead to a very efficient or effective qualitative study on such decisions.
Yeah, certainly my preference as a qualitative researcher is more qualitative data, but I think you're absolutely correct, Tom, that we don't have to take the model just as a given and say, well, this is all you can do. We have a lot richer simulation capabilities now, and that also might give you some more insight.
So I think there is also a possible implication of the paper for a more unexpected field, and it's something related to temporary organizing and even open innovation or even in a way, almost the gig economy, you know, this way in which we have people working together without an organization. Because one of the things that the author says is that, you know, what they're trying to look at here, you know, these anarchic situations, they also have an element, they are characterized by situations in which participation is fluid. I'm not entirely sure what they meant back then, but today, when I think about fluid participation, again, we can think of rapid responsive teams that just come together for a specific issue, or can even think about outsourcing through, you know, actually crowdsourcing, you know, so these different platforms we have to distribute work in which there are people that come and go and join the project for specific tasks, you know, and I think in a way all this setting that they are describing in which, you know, this problem solving in this kind of ambiguous situation kind of fits there somehow.
I think you're right. It's that it seems like the assumption they made for the article was that you'd have the actors in the organization would be the same, but they wouldn't always participate in the same kinds of decisions all the time because they'd have different energy levels. And it sure seems to me, based on the way you described it, those alternate decision structures are about the same or roughly equivalent, where you have different people making different decisions. And you've designed that into your decision process based on how you recruit them or assign teams or that sort of thing. And I think that would be an interesting topic for research. I think it has been researched where you look at these kind of ad hoc teams and how they function, and then how the team dynamics work. Because that's one of the things that, of course, the model leaves out entirely. Is the team dynamics of distributed teams, when there's quite a bit of research on that.
No, I also think more specifically the case, because I know that in crowdsourcing and open innovation, you have specifically sometimes you set up problems in which you recruit people from all over to plug the solutions. So, you know, it's a kind of, you know, extension of the situation that's described here. And then the question is how you coordinate that and how these things get, you know, which solution is going to get picked up and blah, blah, blah. So there is some kind of resemblance. I'm forcing it, but I'm just thinking of, you know, how it can inspire people that are interested in looking at those things.
Well, I think as an overall thought, this was one of the models that I came across already during my university studies when you study organization theory, the basics, the fundamentals. I'd never had the chance to read the original text, so I think this is has been a great opportunity to actually see the mechanics, and I discovered all the modeling aspects of it, even though I didn't understand all of it because it's beyond my usual the things I usually read and deal with. So I find that really fascinating, and I think what is the most interesting part of this piece of work is that you can clearly detect the roots in rational thought and the rational conception of decision making. But at the same time, you have very strong attempts to get closer and closer to the real world of organizations. And even if we go through the main points of our discussion, a lot of the critiques and the observations that we made is that a lot of aspects haven't been taken into account. But at the same time, it is a model, so it's a simplistic representation of reality. So what is interesting is the possibility of opening up each part and getting even more closer to real organizations and to how they work and to how decisions are actually carried out in reality.
Okay. I think my general take-home lesson is, again, that's why I think we read the classics. I had heard of the paper, had read summaries of what the idea is, but as you read it, I think both in reading it and discussing it, I had many insights on different areas I would never think about before, such as the issue of, you know, how the structure of attention in top leaders, things related to, you know, how you can use some of the assumptions in the model to think about organizations in more political or less political terms, how it might translate even to situations of temporary organizing, how it, you know, it covers or not covers so well the issue of agency and, you know, autonomy at the workplace. So, you know, a number of things that we managed to take from that, you know, I think just when you read the summary and has one very narrow take on the text, you don't actually think about.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think both of you identify one of the best features about what we're doing with this article, and that is that even though we didn't always agree with each of the features of the article or maybe some of the assumptions, and some of us got more or less lost. I was one of the lost ones from all the detailed mathematics, just because it was getting in the way of my understanding of what they were trying to accomplish. The article is still accessible, and I think we've had a very rich conversation about the implications of the model and what it might mean for current organizations and streams of research. Both of you talked about the idea that we could get even richer understanding of organizations from the implications of this model, that this could inspire further research. And in fact, it has. It is widely referenced in many papers since then. It has been applied to political organizations, strategy and policymaking in the United Nations, military organizations. And I could see many parallels for organizations I've been in that I thought were more hierarchical and rationally organized, that I realized, no, a lot of what we were doing was garbage can decision model based, even though I didn't really realize it at the time. So I think that's another good reason for people, even if you're not an organizational researcher, to review the article. And that's all for part 3 of episode 39. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com, where you can also subscribe to our newsletter.